Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session.
Good morning. Thank you. You may be seated. We are here today in the case of Flanagan versus Arizona Registrar of Contractors. It's our case number CACV 240725. Each side will have 20 minutes. It's up to the appellant to reserve any time that you'd like for rebuttal. These proceedings are being audio and video recorded, so it's helpful for those who are listening to an audio recording if you'll identify yourself and your client when you begin. We have conference this case. We've read the briefing. We think we're familiar with the facts, and we look forward to your argument. And with that, you may begin.
If it may please the court, my name is Dan Kloberdance. I'm counsel for the complainant, appellant Brian Flanagan. And I'd like to try to reserve at least a few minutes for rebuttal, if possible, hopefully a little bit more than that. As this court knows, this is an appeal from the ROC's second final decision and order. this one was dated in June 2023. And Flanagan's first appeal to this Court of Appeals, this court held that the registrar had erroneously applied a certain superseded tax classification statute that improperly denied Flanagan's eligibility to receive payment from the ROC recovery fund. It's important to note that this court did not remand this case back down to the registrar. Rather, this court remanded the case back to Superior Court for a ruling consistent herewith. This court did not say that the Superior Court could authorize the registrar to raise new defenses that had not been raised by the registrar in the case below. This court did not extend the statutory deadlines under ARS Section 41-1098.08, which requires the ROC to modify the administrative law judge's decision within 30 days.
Didn't the parties stipulate regarding what the ROC would do on remand? So doesn't that presuppose it would go back down?
No. The parties did do a stipulation, but that stipulation does not say that the ROC could take a fresh look. In fact, that's what the ROC wanted me to sign, the stipulation. I refused. I put some things in there that they didn't like, and we ended up with a very lukewarm stipulation that the court signed. That let me read this. The stipulation. Excuse me. I had it right in front of me. The language of the stipulation says exactly what this court ruled, and that is that the ROC has erroneously applied a statute, the tax classification statute, to deny Flanagan's eligibility, and that the court is going to remand the matter back to the ROC for determination.
The court is reversing and saying this is not a final decision. We've reversed. It's going back.
I don't think the court said this is not a final decision. I think the court said you apply the wrong statute. In fact, Your Honor, you were joined in the decision. The court is very careful in this language. Let me read what the court did rule, because I think this is very important in the case, and this is consistent with the stipulation language. We hold that the 2019 amendment governs Flanagan's administrative claim, and therefore the prior version of Section 321131, requiring the damaged property to carry certain tax classifications, does not preclude Flanagan from accessing the recovery fund. Accordingly, we reverse the Superior Court's order and remand for further proceedings consistent herewith. There is nothing in this court's ruling where this court says you can start over, find some new defenses.
There's nothing that says you can't do that.
You can't do that. But this court wasn't even asked to rule on that issue.
But let's say this. I understand you. You think that this is a close call or a call in your favor in terms of how it's interpreted. But let's say there was an obvious second reason that the ROC could have given for denying a claim the first time through, one that none of us would ever disagree with. Are you saying because they didn't raise it during the first proceeding that they've waived permanently, they can't, if they were wrong on the only one they asserted, that they can't come back and assert something that everybody understands is dispositive of the case?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
And what's your best authority for that?
Best authority of that is, well, let's start with, I think, the simplest way to decide this case in my client's favor is look at ARS section 41-1098.08. That requires, I'll read it to you, Your Honor, because this is right on point. This is under the heading Final Administrative Decisions, which no one disputes that we had a final administrative decision here. Final, for purposes of anything. It was a final, it's called final. It's in the title.
Let me ask you, it was final in the sense that it could be challenged in the Superior Court, correct?
It could be challenged by someone who files an appeal. ROC did not file an appeal, and they argue they couldn't,
Counsel,
but they could have.
Let me clarify.
Okay.
It was final in the sense that it could be challenged in Superior Court, correct?
Sure, sure.
That doesn't mean, though, that it was final for all time for all purposes. And in fact, it wasn't. It was appealed to the Superior Court and affirmed, and then appealed to this court and reversed. It went away.
Correct.
So how is that first decision, which at some moment was final agency decision subject to appeal, how is that preclusive?
It's preclusive because the ROC missed the deadlines. They did not. They could have filed an appeal, or they could have. I was arguing the statute should apply in the first matter.
They
said no.
How were they aggrieved? What was there for them to challenge in Superior Court from the final agency determination?
Well, let me start. On all due respect, the party doesn't have to be aggrieved to have a right to appeal. The statute clearly says a party may appeal.
But when you prevail below, what would ever be the incentive for saying we're going to appeal the ruling that we just prevailed?
Well, the incentive is if you plan on raising new defenses, you want to reserve those rights. That's the incentive.
And that's assuming they're going to lose on appeal.
Right. And that's the incentive. They knew that I was arguing that they were applying the wrong statute. They could have issued an alternative decision where they could have said, if this statute applies, we deny it because the tax classification. If that statute doesn't apply because it's been supersedis, then we're gonna deny eligibility because not all the trustors intend to live in the house because both trustors are dead. So they could have argued that. And I gotta push back here a little bit, Your Honors. Ironically, when I prevailed in the first court of appeals action, this court denied my attorney's fees because I didn't file an attorney fee application after I lost the case down below.
Same
principle applies.
Counsel, you're not arguing that the rules of appellate procedure govern ROC administrative proceedings, are you?
No, I don't think I'm making that argument.
I didn't think you were, but that kind of seemed like the permutation of what you just described.
No, I'm arguing that the statutory requirement that the ROC within 30 days submits its rejection or modification of the ALJ's ruling. And the word in the statute, I was about to read it, says within 30 days after the date the office sends a copy of the administrative law judge's decision to the head of the agency, the ROC may review the decision and accept, reject, or modify it. It goes on to say this has to be done within 30, must be done within 30 days.
That makes complete sense when they want to challenge the ruling, but they don't want to challenge the ruling, so it still seems odd to me that would somehow render the entire proceedings final when the case is ultimately reversed on appeal, and they had no incentive, no reason to say that, a reason to file an appeal saying you got it wrong.
I disagree because I was arguing, and the record's very clear about this, adamantly arguing.
Let's say you hadn't argued it. It's just as a principle, a matter of principle, when there's a decision, an administrative decision that is then appealed. Let's say the attorney doesn't say, well, you better raise all your arguments. I'm not aware of any legal authority that says the ROC has to raise some alternative claims for upholding the decision at that stage.
Well, I'm not, there's no legal authority that says the ROC has the right to raise new defenses after they lose the first case. In fact, to the contrary, there's an appeal deadline and statutory deadlines under 41-1092 that have these deadlines. This court, in fact, it wasn't even before this court did what it was supposed to do. It ruled on the only issue in front of this court, and that is, did the OLC erroneously deny Flanagan's eligibility for recovery fund because the property had been previously classified as a rental property, the tax classification issue?
Isn't another way to say it that this court addressed whether the ROC applied a superseded statute? Isn't that what the court did?
That's not the issue in front of this court, but that's the question that answers the issue that was in front of this court.
Well, let me be really clear. Isn't that what the prior appeal decided?
Not exactly, Your Honor, and I'm splitting hairs, but I have to.
Help me better understand, recognizing we have some familiarity with that decision.
This court did not say that there's nothing in this court's opinion, and again, it wasn't this within the authority of the court to even say this. There's nothing in this court's opinion that says, ROC, you applied the wrong statute. Go back and apply the new statute and you may come up with some new defenses. Nothing in the decision that says that. This court didn't have authority to even do that because the ROC wasn't arguing that. They weren't arguing they had a right to come back and reserve the right. They didn't ask for an extension of these deadlines that they missed. They didn't ask for maybe it was a motion for a relief from judgment or something that would allow them to not be bound by their final decision.
Counsel, let me ask you a jurisdictional question. I hear some of what you're saying today is saying that there was a violation of the law, the mandate, that the Superior Court or perhaps the ROC didn't follow the mandate from this court in the prior appeal.
No, I'm not saying that. The mandate was neutral, let me say that. It didn't.
So it wasn't what the prior appeal said. It was something else that you claim was error after remand.
Yes, because they didn't. They missed the deadlines under the statutes, and the 32 months after the ALJ entered his order, then 32 months, and the statute requires 30 days.
And I understand that, but there were two administrative hearings here, right? The first one leading to the first appeal,
right?
And then the second one leading to this appeal, don't those clocks start anew?
No, absolutely not.
Help me better understand that. What's your best authority for the proposition that if an agency applies the incorrect statute and a court says, no, you applied the incorrect statute, go do it again?
No, the court did not say that. The court did not.
Bear with me, counsel. What is your best authority for the proposition that the ROC then, for example, could apply no statute because the court didn't say you can apply the appropriate law?
I'm not sure I understood your question, Your Honor.
I'm trying to understand your argument.
Okay.
And if it's not based on what the prior appeal said, and I've just heard you say it's not, what was left for the ROC to apply, given that the prior appeal, from my perspective at least, said you applied the wrong statute?
Nothing. And there was nothing left for them to do other than the calculations of how much the recovery fund is going to
so
be.
So wouldn't the mandate
$30,000 minus the bond?
Wouldn't the mandate from the prior decision more accurately then say we remand this case for entry of judgment in favor of your client? And it didn't say
no, because that wasn't in front of the court either. So the court could only rule upon what's before the court and the record before the court. There was nothing before this court about if there were any other defenses that might have already been raised below. This court wasn't, those issues weren't in front of this court.
Let's take it, just humoring for a minute in terms of, let's say this is not an administrative appeal, it's just a normal case where it comes up and we reverse on one ruling that came up. This was just, you didn't have an administrative proceeding, you just went straight to Superior Court, and the other party only raised one defense, the Superior Court ruled in their favor, it's appealed. When we reverse that decision and send it back, we're not in an administrative hearing, do you agree that there's no finality and you go back and you just start over and anything can be raised?
Not necessarily, no. Let's say that the plaintiff, that or the party gets the one of the parties wants to raise a new claim that would have otherwise been barred by the statute.
You're not raising a new claim. This is just a defense to the same.
It's a new defense.
Right?
It's a new defense.
And you're saying that can't be done if they pointed out the statute says you can't raise this type of claim.
Well, this statute only applies to administrative law action, so
right,
it's
just in terms of finality.
I would agree with you. I think in most cases that you start new, but these rules are entirely different.
So you're relying solely on the fact that you're saying under the rules they have to challenge the ruling that was in their favor. They have an obligation to
yes.
do that, or when it goes back, they can't raise
yes,
it.
Yes, as I had an obligation to file an application for attorney's fees when I lost the case. Same principle. They went all in on the tax classification issue. That was the only defense they raised. They raised that defense at the beginning, and all the way through this appeal, they never raised another defense, and they never asked for any stay of any deadlines or any extensions of any deadlines. So they are bound by that decision.
Are you aware of any case saying that?
No.
Okay.
Not a case either way. Just believe me. I looked. It's not there. May I real quickly talk about the merits of the case? All the trustors. let's assume that statute applies. All the trustors. When a person dies, sadly, that person no longer has legal capacity. It estate's formed for that deceased person. The statute says all the trustors must intend to occupy the property. Here, there were two trustors, William and Georgia Flanagan. Georgia dies first, Flanagan's survivor, William's the survivor. William dies, there are no trustors living. Then the subject transaction happens. It's my position, I feel very passionate about this, that the word all the trustors has to mean all the trustors who are trustors as of the time of the transaction. And if someone is deceased, they are not a trustor anymore. They were a trustor, just like if there was a rule that said the entire board of directors must pass this resolution for this to be legal. One of the members dies. They have the vote the next day. That person doesn't vote. Is the requirement of all the board's members satisfied? Yeah, I think absolutely. Same case here, because when someone dies, they're no longer a trustor.
What if
legally?
What if it's now in trust and the trustee wants to rent it out? You're saying this applies to trustees, even though there's
I'm arguing trustees. No, I'm not saying that at all.
You are, because there is
essentially
no trustor.
It's the same effect, but I'm not arguing that trustee means trustor. But I'm saying there are no trustors. In this particular case,
but that's why if the property goes to someone else and if they qualify, if it's essentially an owner-occupied property, then they get the benefit of this statute.
Well, that didn't happen here, Your Honor. And if that were a situation, I'd be dancing on pins trying to explain how that's justified. But that's not the situation here. Here we have a situation where Brian Flanagan, who became the successor trustee, he's also the beneficiary, tended to live in the home. That's not disputed. And the RLC's taking the position that, well, you're deceased. If we take their position, even William Flanagan, the surviving trustor, wouldn't be eligible for recovery fund because his wife had already passed away. She was the trustor. If you want to say all the trustors includes deceased people, then it includes both William and Georgia.
You're asking us to essentially insert the word living into the statute. Isn't that the legislature's role?
Yes, and they're asking you to insert the word deceased. so it goes both ways. I can argue that, yeah, if the legislature thought about it, I argue in common sense that if the legislature meant that if one of the original trustors dies, they're no longer eligible. Period, you're done. If one of you dies, you can never be eligible for recovery fund. I'm arguing if the legislature meant that, they would have said that. They're arguing the flip-flop if they meant to include, that deceased trustors are no longer part of the factor.
It's an interesting argument. There would be a trustor who's alive and who intends to live there. But here we don't have any trustor.
Yeah, but this is their position. All the trustors means all. They include both Georgia and William. So that's their position. It's just certainly not consistent with the legislative intent of a consumer protection law. I've got a minute and a half. May I reserve, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Good Good morning. May it please the court, Charles Hover, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Registrar of Contractors. Addressing directly the lead-off argument that was made by counsel for Mr. Flanagan, the issue is directed specifically to what this remand was and what its effect would have. I would refer the court to the cases cited in our brief, the first being Zavala versus Arizona State Personnel Board, which states, the general rule seems to be that where an administrative agency has been found to have acted in violation of procedural requirements or arbitrarily, the administrative agency is entitled to have the proceedings returned to it. A remand for further proceedings means that the case is returned to the administrative agency so that it may take further action in accordance with the applicable law. Such a remand does not dismiss or terminate the administrative proceeding. Rather, the administrative agency may take a fresh look at the matter involved.
Are there any limits if say, the ROC has four bases for denying a claim? They offer one, it's reversed on appeal up through our court. They offer a second one, it's reversed on appeal. They can keep raising, here's reason number three we could have raised the first time. Is there any authority that says they can't do that?
There is not any authority that prohibits that. As for a matter of good practice, appeal after appeal after appeal would not find favor, I'm sure, and at some point be halted. However, in this particular case, the matter was returned to the agency with the court's explicit recognition in paragraph 19 of its opinion in Flanagan versus Arizona Registrar, which states that further, the revocation or suspension of the contractor's license does not guarantee the claimant's administrative claim will ultimately be granted even when a claim is filed. In the normal case, under either version of the statutes, factual questions remain regarding eligibility that may prevent payment.
But isn't that, counsel, kind of a description of how the fund works? What you just described in the prior opinion?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a fair description. I signed off on that description.
Yes.
Of that, but I don't think that really addresses what we're talking about here, does it?
I think it does, because the point being made is that this court did not remand for any further consideration by the registrar of its claim under the correct statutes. In this particular paragraph, this court expressly recognized that there were issues that the administrative agency would still have to address and that the claimant would have to prove up in further review on remand. The court then went further in paragraph 20 and stated that the ROC concedes that the claimant will still have to prove he has the right type of property under ARS section 321132 and the appropriate amount of the award under ARS section 321132.01. The court then, in its conclusion, we hold that the 2019 amendment governs Flanagan's administrative claim, and therefore the prior version of 321131 requiring the damaged property to carry certain tax classifications does not preclude Flanagan from accessing the recovery fund. Accordingly, we reverse the Superior Court's order and remand for further proceedings consistent herewith. The parties then, on remand to the Superior Court, stipulated that in the memorandum decision, the Arizona Court of Appeals reversed this court's JRAD ruling and remanded for further proceedings consistent with the memorandum decision. Pursuant to the memorandum decision, the ROC should not determine that Flanagan is ineligible to receive payment from the recovery fund because of the tax classification of the subject property pursuant to the pre-August 27th, 2019 version of ARS section 321131.
Is another way of looking at this, let's say the previous statute did not have any provision for occupied by a trustor intended to be occupied, but it said it would be denied if it's not, doesn't meet this tax classification. We said you applied the wrong statute. The new statute has an additional element that says it must be occupied by the trustor. If we send it back and say you have to apply it under the new statute, presumably that would be a basis for denying relief under the new statute. I'm throwing this out. It's kind of a softball that it's if this is in the new statute, it wasn't in the old statute. Would there be any reason why the ROC would not be entitled to apply the new statute that had additional requirements?
No, sir. Under the court ruling and the remand, the registrar would be required under its duties to administer the fund to apply the current law as set out in the courts and in the statutes.
Counsel, in response to Presiding Judge Catani's question about the sort of four issues, hypothetical.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned, you know, at some point, you suggested, how about that, at some point, there would be too much that for example, perhaps the third or the fourth time back, that might be too far. How do we divine any sort of guidance from that? Or can the ROC just do it in a, not even a onesie-twosie, but just one issue, see if that works, that doesn't, go to another issue, see if that works, take everything through appeals, and then, you know, a dozen years later, get a final decision when all of those issues could have been wrapped up at one point?
I would assume that engaging in perhaps bad faith serial litigation, trying it point after point after point, would run afoul of various ethical law rules and statutory procedural rules.
Which makes sense to me, and I'm not attributing bad faith here. I'm saying, you know, litigation is done best when everything's resolved all at once. And if appeals are taken, there's one of those, not two. And we have sort of an example here where that did not happen. And you're arguing that wasn't a bridge too far. This was fine for purposes of this case. But what would a bridge too far be, and how would we identify that?
In this particular case, you had two competing statutes that were run one right up against the other with regard to when they were to be applied. The registrar, in good faith, based upon its determination that it was going to apply the statute that was applicable at the time that the claim arose, followed that process, that procedure, and those laws. It wasn't a situation where they looked at something and said, oh, this might get us in trouble, let's kind of push that off to the side.
But I think he's asking, you could have looked at the previous statute and said, oh, and by the way, they're not trustors who are living there.
Don't quite follow that.
At the time of the first appeal,
yes,
what was the trustor? The trustor was not alive then either.
Correct.
So they could have, the ROC could have raised both defenses the first time and said it doesn't meet the proper tax classification and it's not going to be occupied by one of the trustors.
The question that was actually carried forward was, again, a stipulated, we will determine whether or not this particular new statute is the one which applies or whether the previous pre-amendment.
Well, when they initially brought the claim, you could have raised that as a defense and said, yeah, you lose under this, under the previous statute, and you lose under the fact that it's not going to be occupied by the trustor. And I understand you feel strongly that you're correct under the previous statute on the tax classification. I think the questions have just been, wouldn't it make sense to raise both defenses at the same time? And I agree, it's hindsight, I understand that, but...
Are you talking about...
Was there a reason not to say... Initially, this is not going to be, the trustor is not going to live in the property. That's another basis for denying your claim.
In addition to the underlying tax classification argument that ROC made below.
I suppose it could have been addressed in foresight and hindsight, But the focus at that point in time was the statutory scheme that they believed was in place and was applicable, which did not include the trustor classification or requirement at all. That was in the new statute, which was remanded back to them with specific orders. This is how you consider it. This is what you look at. And that's what was done, and that's what is on appeal at this particular point in time.
And I think the question before us is there some authority stating that the ROC was precluded from raising the additional trustor defense on remand?
No. I believe that the remand was broad enough, given the court's recognition that there's going to have to be a determination as to whether or not the claimant actually met the criteria under the new statute, to give the registrar direction as to how it is to proceed and what it is to consider.
And I apologize. I may just be misremembering. I thought the requirement was in the previous statute as well, that it had to be kind of owner-occupied, that included a trustor. Was that something that's only in the new statute? And it's something we can find in the record if it's not on the top of your head.
It's not. It should be, but it's not, and I apologize.
No, it should be on mine as well, so no problem.
But at any rate, the tax classification, I'm pretty sure, did not require at that point in time the distinction between trustor, trustee, all of that information. It was just almost a mathematical calculation. Does this fit within that tax classification? If it doesn't, you aren't entitled to access the fund. With regard to the argument that somehow the registrar has gone back and raised a new defense, I would push back on that, in that I think there is a conflation here with what is a defense versus what the registrar actually does in interpreting and applying the statutory guidance from the legislature. The claimant has pressed that issue forward almost as if it is an affirmative defense to the claim, much like a violation of the statute of limitations. In this particular case, I think it is inaccurate to talk about what the registrar is doing as applying a new defense to this case. What the registrar is doing is applying new statutory criteria that it is charged by the legislature with reviewing, applying the facts to, and determining whether or not they meet that particular statutory provision.
And not the facts of this case, but what would your answer be if there's one trustor who's living and one trustor is no longer living? The living trustor intends to live in the property. Would that be something that would entitle them to compensation?
Your Honor, the statute speaks specifically to trustors. That is the term that the legislature chose. That is the term that is in the statute. And those are the terms that the registrar is charged
but
to
if there is, there's
follow.
A, there's a surviving trustor who is surviving, so still alive. Would that person not be entitled to pursue a claim?
Under the language of the statute, and harsh as it may be, I don't believe so. The language is very clear. It is not ambiguous. It requires all trustors at the time. All trustors intend to occupy or are occupying.
Let me ask on that, and one that I don't think is at issue here today, but the types of trusts that are eligible to are, at least as what we're presented with, are revocable trusts, right?
Yes, sir.
And it would seem to me that there are many revocable trusts created by trustors that when one or both or all of the trustors die, that would become irrevocable at that point, if in terms of estate planning or other, for completely unrelated purposes.
Yes, that's my understanding.
Is that struck me that it's specific, a specific and narrow type of trust, that can be applicable here.
Yes.
And it seemed to me that this was really designed for owner-occupied or intended to be owner-occupied, not rentor-owned properties. Is that a fair, so it's a subset of all properties that people live in that could be eligible for a claim?
Yes, and that is consistent with the statute as a whole, which identifies very specific persons who are entitled to access the recovery fund. Not all persons are. And this statute makes it very clear that a subcategory of those eligible are trustors, but with the further limitation that it must be all trustors at the time.
Well, it seems like intent. An easier way to get there is to say a trust becomes irrevocable once one of the trustor has died, and at least my basic understanding of how trusts work. And it makes more sense, at least from my perspective, if you're just saying we want husband and wife who are living in a house, we want them to be treated the same regardless whether they have created an estate plan, but they're both still alive for all intents and purposes, the same thing. But we don't want trusts in general. If there's just a non-revocable trust, they're not going to get the benefit of this provision. But as long as it's really just two people who could at any time decide to pull it out of the trust and still just have it be their own personal property, we're going to treat them the same. But once one person dies, the trust becomes irrevocable, so it seems like that would be another way of harmonizing this with the statute and saying it's not a revocable trust anymore.
Yes.
Even if there were one trustor.
Certainly the trust is irrevocable at that time, and the statute is specific that it must be a revocable trust that is entitled to access the funds. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the order and opinion of the Superior Court be affirmed. Thank you.
Very good question on the revocable trust, and that I think that's something this court should consider in interpreting the statute is what all the trustors means in reference to the issue where both the trustors have died. Here, and you're correct, Your Honor, but here the ALJ found specifically, and I'll read you Section 7 of the May 17th, 2023 decision. In this case, the evidence established that the Flanagan Family Trust is a revocable trust. ROC agreed with that. So that's off the table. That should have been the issue they raised if they were going to raise an issue later. But here, there's a finding from the ALJ that the Flanagan Family Trust is a revocable living trust. ROC accepts that. Now they're arguing, it's irrevocable.
Just to be clear, it was a question that I had. I don't see the ROC arguing that. Yeah. I don't think
they've
that issue's in front.
Alluded to it. But I think that's important to note when you look at what the statute did. The legislature, probably because they had someone understood trust, at least a little bit on there, said, hey, if this is irrevocable trust situation, we're not going to allow them to have recovery. And if it's a revocable trust, which we have to assume it is here because that was the finding, if it's a revocable trust, then we want all the trustors to intend to live in the home. But I don't think they were contemplating deceased trustors because, and again, the word trustor means somebody who has legal capacity to act as a trustor of a trust. And if you are deceased, you are not a trustor anymore. You are dead. And
you certainly can't revoke the trust at that time.
You can't revoke the trust at that time. So I can see I'm out of time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument. We will take this matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course. And with that, we're adjourned.